Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event. Able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
Hey everyone, this is Superhero Speak, and this is Dave talking. So, we're starting out this week's episode with an apology. That's to Travis McIntyre, our guest this week, which we actually recorded this episode over a month ago, but due to different scheduling conflicts, we're just releasing it now. And at the end of the episode, you'll hear Travis talk about things that are coming out soon, which are now are out and available. So please, listen to the episode, and then check out all his links in the description of the episode, and give his comics a read. He's a really great guy. This was a great interview. Oh, and by the way, if you happen to be at the Great Philadelphia Comic Con this weekend in Oaks, PA, we will be there. We are going to be walking around interviewing people and putting together an episode for next week. So if you're going to be there, look for us and say hi. And until then, listen to our interview with Travis McIntyre.
Hey, everyone. You're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host, Dave.
I'm John.
And this week we have a very special guest with us. He is the author of Bayani and the Nine Daughters of the Moon for Caliber Comics, and he's also the editor-in-chief of Sourcepoint Press. So everyone, please welcome Travis McIntyre to the show. How are you doing, sir?
Very, very well. Thanks a lot for having me.
Oh, no, thank you for doing it. So, as we usually like to kick these shows off, when did you get interested in the comics?
Well, like a lot of people, I think my interest in comics started when I was actually quite little. I'm just old enough to remember news coming to the grocery store and whatnot, like once a week as a little kid with my mom and getting comics. So from probably the mid 80s through, my early college years, I was of comics. And then, I went to school in a city called Kalamazoo, Michigan, Western Michigan University. And at the time there, they had what is now a pretty big animation festival. And I as a student, I got involved a little bit in the animation festival, doing some writing for that, for different things. And I really enjoyed it, but I never really thought about going into comics until, I got out of school and then... 10 years go by, I'm married, I have a career, and I guess I just was getting a little bit bored, and I wanted to do something a little more creative, and around the same time, a friend of mine was in art school, continuing education, and he was taking a class on graphic, sequential art, mm-hmm. And so he asked me to write him a short script. So I did, and we had a really good time, and I kind of was like, I'm probably... responsible enough to to try to make a real go at this. So I started putting together, some more scripts and doing some writing and workshopping and all the kind of normal stuff that you do. And I got incredibly lucky, to be honest with you. I've been incredibly lucky, both with like the people that I've met and the people that I've worked with and the people that have helped me and boosted me along and introduced me to this person or that person. And, it's a very, very competitive industry, and it's difficult to kind of break in. I don't really like to use that terminology because people seem to think that like, well, once you're in, and that's doesn't seem, in my experience, it's like a constant struggle. But yeah, essentially it was, wait around long enough, get to the point where you just really want to try it. You don't care if you're successful or not, and then get super lucky. That's my story.
Well, that's an interesting story. And it seems like a big jump to go from helping a friend out, writing a script for him, to being the editor-in-chief of a company. So, was that a goal? Like, you wanted to get to that level, or... did you just kind of fall into that?
I definitely didn't. It wasn't really what I started out wanting to do. I started out, finding a couple different artists to put together some short little pieces that I could use as pitch material, and I had written some things, and I got incredibly lucky, and an editor at Dark Horse, which is a relatively big publisher, I don't know if he just was having a really good day that day or what, but he took some time out to actually respond to a submission that I'd sent in and, kind of give me some real feedback on the script I was writing and you know, and it wasn't terribly good or anything like that. I just think I caught a guy at the right time on the right day and really helped me out, really helped me make it more professional. So I started kind of shopping around this horror story called Up the River, which is sort of like a Huckleberry Finn meets Mad Max kind of story. Because I'm really interested in turn of the century American literature. I love Mark Twain. I love Huckleberry Finn. So I wanted to do this. It's kind of two kids see their father murdered, and they end up going on a riverboat journey through a post-apocalyptic wasteland, and try to figure out why this happened. And then of course they find out that their dad was never who they thought he was, and all this other whatnot. So I was pitching it around, and there's a small publisher based out of Detroit called Source Point Press that I really liked a lot of the stuff they were doing. They were doing a book called Jack of Spades, which was this like old fashioned Sam Spade kind of riff, black and white film noir style comic, and they were doing a bunch of other cool stuff that I was really into, and I loved their attitude about, we're just going to try to make this happen and we're going to continue pushing forward no matter what. So they offered me a contract to do Up the River. So we started doing it, and that was really cool. And over the course of kind of working through the growing pains of that first book, I got to know the two guys, Josh Werner and Trico Lutkins, are the two founders of Source Point. Amazingly awesome guys. Driven, brilliant artists, great, great people. Then I got to be really good friends with them, and I'm a research scientist by trade. So I'm pretty, mathematically minded, I guess. And so kind of got to know these guys pretty well, and eventually kind of started to get a little bit of a look at their books. And not the books that they were publishing, their, accounts. And then I was like, I think I could really help you guys out to, not be bankrupt soon. So one thing led to another, and over the course of the next, year and a half, we entered into a partnership, and, and now I'm the editor-in-chief. But those two guys are very much involved. Josh is the art director, and Trico's a manager and sales manager and all that stuff. So it wasn't like a hostile takeover or anything like that.
Ah, so you say. So
yeah, don't ask those guys also. don't ask them. No, it was really more of a, they were like, we're really struggling. I was like, well, let me take a look at it. I analyzed data sets all day long. And I was, they're both kind of artist-minded people, and I was like, well, some of your problems are pretty obvious, We can fix a lot of this stuff with, no problem. So it's been a long road, but things have really solidified in the last probably 8 or 9 months. We really, turned a corner and started to grow really fast, like growing to the point where I'm starting to get concerned about it.
Well, it's a good concern then.
It is. It's a good concern. It's one of those things where I was talking to Josh the other day. I'm like, I feel like we both need to get an intern. And he's like, yeah, I've had an intern before. That actually makes it more work because you're teaching the intern. I'm like, well, I don't want that.
Right.
So we're trying to figure out some way to basically get like a someone who will work for intern wages, but knows as much as someone who would be qualified to be like an art director. So probably not be successful.
I was gonna say that's gonna be difficult.
Yeah, no, I'm And I'm kidding. I'm kidding to an extent, but yeah, I mean, we're not. We're not to the point where we can afford to hire on a bunch of people, but we're getting to the point almost where we will have to. So we'll see how it goes. It's been quite a ride.
Right. So anyone listening who is a talented art director and wants to work for free, give Travis a call. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, or very very low. Low wages, embarrassingly low.
Do you guys just do horror comics over there, or
We do horror, sci-fi, supernatural. We do a lot of pulp stuff. We do a lot of mystery kind of stuff like that. Generally, we try to stay in that niche. We've sort of found that we have a little bit of a fan base there, and we feel like we kind of know what we're doing in that, in those genres, and that there's like a pretty hardcore business side to it, in that I think most independent creators will tell you that superhero stuff is a super hard sell on the independent circuit. And one of the things that maybe a lot of independent creators wouldn't say is that part of the reason that it's such a hard sell is that you're competing against the best in the world, Like, if you go into horror comics, you're competing with the idiots like me. you have a chance to carve out your niche, If you go into superheroes, you've got Grant Snyder to contend with. Good luck. So yeah, some of it is just purely mercenary choice. But I think a lot of it has to do with when Josh Werner and I kind of were getting to know each other and becoming friends. We both were big fans of kind of the 50s era pulp comics, the easy horror stuff, the weird horror stuff and the weird mystery stuff that was being published at the time. We actually do a title called Classic Pulp where we actually hunt down those old issues, and then because most of them are like big comics, with lots of little short stories in them. Mm-hmm. And then we figure out which ones are in the public domain, and then we scan them in, and then Josh like painstakingly goes through panel by panel and digitally restores them, and we republish them as a collected book called Classic Pulp, which we've done two volumes of.
Oh, that's cool.
It is. Well, I mean, it's people who are into it. It's immediate. They're like, oh my God, take my money.
Right.
But you got to find
the nice.
You got to find the right.
Right. No. And it's, cause we've had people on the show before who've talked about that. And it's surprising how much stuff there is out there from, the 40s and the 50s that are that is in the public domain now and they're characters that people forgot about too.
Oh yeah. There's a ton of stuff. We look at things that are in the public domain all the time, stuff and underground scripts and comic strips from that era. And plus I get pitches, pretty regularly. There's one that we, are doing right now. It's a movie from 1963, called The Terror. It's a super early Jack Nicholson movie.
Okay. Hmm.
And it is awful. It is absolutely terrible, god awful. But we're going to spit shine it up, I think, and end up doing a graphic novelization of it that I think is going to end up being, we're going to kind of play it a little bit more like a comedy, because that's sort of what it's turned into over the last 50 years.
Ah, and is Jack Nicholson paying good money to keep that underground?
we'll find out once this podcast goes live.
No,
if you guys never hear from me again, then the answer to that is yes.
Or if you never hear from us again. Jack, we've got your number.
Right.
Cool. So, also kind of interesting too, because you do the Biani, and then, it's a long title. I have to look at my notes.
Biani and Nine Daughters of the Moon.
Yes, which is an all ages book. So that's a. I'm kind of curious where that came from, because obviously there's an interesting there's a difference. Thank you.
Dichotomy
between an all ages book and a horror book, a post apocalyptic version of Tom Sawyer.
Yeah, okay, so there's a very, very clear reason for that. The very, very first time I was invited by a comic store to come in and do a signing was on Free Comic Book Day. Are you guys familiar with Free Comic Book Day?
Oh, yeah.
It's usually the first Saturday in May, mm-hmm. and the store I was at, it makes a big deal out of it. Like, a lot of stores make a big deal out of it. This place goes above and beyond. Like, it is the closest feeling to, like, being at a big con that you can get in a small shop.
Mm-hmm.
He does a great job pubbing it, and it feels like the entire community comes out and comes through that store. And I'm there, and I'm really excited, and I've got this... There's not, like, a ton of swearing, but there is some blood, there's some gore, it's a horror book. And, you know, you're like, yeah, these two kids see their father murdered, and, you know, that's kind of my pitch. And that's the only thing I have. And I sat there and I literally had to tell like 300 kids that, you know, oh, sorry, this isn't for kids. This isn't for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it was incredibly relaxing in so many ways because, you know, you have your first book out, you know, from an actual publisher and you know, your jaded comic fan doesn't really care that much. They're like, do you write Batman? And you're like, no. They're like, then I don't care about whatever it is you have. But little kids are like, what? You write comic books? This is awesome. I want your comic. And then you have to say, yeah, but you not for kids. So that sucked. That was a huge lesson to me. The other major thing is I have a 3-year-old and now I have a 1.5-year-old too.
Mm-hmm.
And through the course of, and I think this happens with every father, or at least definitely with my father, it happened, sort of like telling nonsense stories, like as you're just like talking, like I tell them nonsense stories, you know, like just gobbledygook.
Right, right.
You know, just telling them goofball stories and making dumb rhymes and things like that, making them laugh and things like that. And, so I had it kind of kicking around in my brain to do something that was a little bit like a kid's book. But originally it wasn't what it came in to be. So I've got that thing going on. Like, I want to do a kid's book. It sucked not having anything that a kid can buy, doing a store signing. And I have kids, so I want to do something that way. At the same time, I was researching, for a different story. So, there's an artist out of the UK named Grant Perkins, and him and I had collaborated on a book that is actually it's been signed, but it's still kind of sitting. It hasn't been released yet, going on 2 years now. But we had collaborated on a book. He's probably most known for doing Penguins of Madagascar.
Oh, okay.
He did the Penguins of Madagascar comic through Titan Comics, and he's done a few other things. He did some Doctor Who stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Super cool guy. The real Grant Perkins on Twitter. His work is really, really awesome. So we had collaborated on something, and we were talking about, let's do some other thing. And he was showing me some of his other work, and he had this little 3-page short that he did with the writer Andy Lanning, who's the guy who wrote Guardians of the Galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
So this little 3-page short, which is about the Filipino myth of the sun and the moon Filipino myth, and I loved the art style that Grant was using. And I thought, man, we should do something like this, and we'll make it a fun horror book. So I started researching, you know, this particular myth and like monsters in Filipino folklore. And I discovered that it is the most messed up stuff. It is crazy messed up, these monsters. Especially if you're coming at it from like a more Western storytelling tradition, you know, where you're kind of used to werewolves and witches and vampires and those kinds of things, you know, things that came from our European, you know, folklore tradition.
Right.
This stuff is completely different. It's like monsters made of tongues and old women that like steal hair and tie knots around earthworms and then pull the hair until the earthworm rips apart. And as they cut the earthworm into pieces with your hair, like pieces of your body fall off, like really weird stuff. Okay. And so I really, really like it.
Sounds like some of the Japanese myths and Chinese myths.
Yeah, it's like that. It's like when you come bad at it with this sort of viewpoint, you know, like the stories feel like really foreign and really like, what? How would you think, where would you come up with this idea? But, you know, if you hadn't been hearing about, you know, Grimm's fairy tales since you were little, then some of those probably seem super strange. And Filipinos are like, what? Tongue monsters? That's how you, what? That's what you make monsters from is tongues. So I started kind of researching that, and I kind of got into this whole like internet rabbit hole of digging around in it, and then all of a sudden I was like, oh my god, I will put this together and I will make this a kid's book, because kids' books can be super creepy, but at the same time you can make them not creepy, you know. And I was like, it was like this eureka moment of like, yes, this is perfect. It'll be like a monster hunter, and then I'll just come up with a, all right, we got, so now we have to have a MacGuffin or which will be a boy and a girl, and it's like, it's going to be Harry and Hermione, this is perfect, you know, and they'll run around, and they'll, you know, they have to go and fight this monster, and this one, and then I'm like, Pokemon, you know, so the story came together very, very easily, like, all, almost, like, handed to me in one, like, box, like, hey, this is cool, look at all the, and look at all the things that it's a little, has these little flavors to it. So I was like, cool, great. So I told Grant, like, hey, I've got this idea of maybe using this. And Andy Laney was nice, really, really nice enough to say, yeah, you guys, you know, take what we started with this little three-page thing. We never did anything, but do whatever you want. So we built on that, and then, you know, and then we had I think we had the first two issues completely done, and I had started pitching it around, and I'd gotten some interest. I'd gotten a little bit of interest from a couple of publishers who liked it, but one of the things that you get a lot with kids' comics is that people are not super interested unless it's a license. Mm-hmm. So you'll get a lot of like, oh, this is really cool, I love the art style, but we only do licensing. You know, we do My Little Pony and Transformers, and, you know, we do licensed stuff. So, you know, I went through, like, the usual places and got a bunch of rejections. And I'd known Gary Reed, the editor-in-chief of Caliber, for, I don't know, maybe a year or two by now. I kind of knew him through the convention scene a little bit. And he's a cool dude, and Caliber, especially if you're from Michigan, Caliber is extremely, you know, respected. They're one of the very first indie comic book longest running. A ton of people got their start there. That's where Bendis got his start. Neil Gaiman worked for them. The Crow came from Caliber. All kinds of stuff. But they'd mostly done like dark, gritty adult stuff. So I'd pitched him a few things, and he'd like sort of very politely shot me down. We were at Traverse City. We were at the Traverse City Comic Con, Cherry Capital Comic Con. And he came by, and we were just like kind of BSing a little bit back and forth, you know, how's it going, blah, blah, blah. And I said, hey, I've got this book I've been working on. And he was like, oh, yeah, do you have any of it done? I was like, yeah, we got two issues done. And like the dork that I am, I have it on my phone, right? Hmm. So, you know, I pull it up. I'm like, check this out, and he's like flipping through it, and I'm not trying to pitch it to him at all, because to me, I'm like, this does not fit what Caliber does. I'm pitching somebody who, just to show him that I did this, you know, I'm not trying to sell it to him or anything. Mm-hmm. And he flips through it, and he's like, oh, this is really cool. You know, the art's really cool. I love the colors. And then he says, you know, in 2016, we're looking to do a real push with Caliber, because they hadn't been doing new books for a long time. They'd been doing, like, reissuing their back issue stuff, and they hadn't been doing new, you know, issues of comics. And we're looking to do some new stuff, and we'd kind of like to do maybe a younger audience thing. You know, after this is over, why don't you send me your whole package? So I was completely blown away, like, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like, literally, like the dork that I am, on Monday I shot it off, and on Tuesday he got back to me and was like, yeah, let's do it. And so that's kind of how Bionic came to be.
Oh, cool. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, and I can't, definitely can't fault you for that, you know, because I'm a father too, and I understand, you know, you work on stuff, and then it's like, well, I want to be able to do something I can show my kids.
Yeah.
You know? And,
yeah, or something you can kind of share with them a little bit.
Right, right.
Yeah, share with them now.
Right, you know? Exactly. Not when they're, not when they're 18 or 16 or, yeah. Right.
I can just imagine. So that's good. I don't want to read your comics, Dad. That's going to be great. Can't wait for that.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's coming before you know it.
Is that where you're at now?
Yes. Yeah. Mine are, well, actually, my daughter's 22 and my son is going to be 14. So, yeah.
Oh, wow. Man.
Yes.
Some days I'm like, I can't wait for that. And other days I'm like, that's got to be the worst.
Well, the worst is the daughter's is graduating college and then getting married at the end of the year, so she won't be here anymore. So it'll just be me, the wife, and the 14-year-old.
Oh boy.
Yes, I mean, he's even gotten to the point where, like, he unless it's a movie he really wants to see, he won't even go to the movies with me a lot of times anymore. So yeah, it's tough.
Oh man. Yeah, that's got to be kind of a bummer. Because, like, right now, they want to hang out with me way more than I want to hang out with them. Like, you know, not to be too much of a jerk about it, but, like, seriously, if I didn't have my office door locked right now, they'd be in here like, what are you doing, Dad? Dad, what are you doing? Who are you talking to? Why are you talking to your computer?
Yeah. So our next question will be, what would you like to tell your daughters in the future when they're listening to this right now?
He doesn't have an answer.
I'm trying to think of
something clever that doesn't sound too awful, but
I never bother with the not awful thing because it's too hard. So I just go straight for clever and whatever comes out, comes out.
No sense sugarcoating it.
Nope.
No, they're great. And I'm really, really happy with how the whole thing kind of worked out. You know, I didn't really see myself kind of doing a kid's book. And I think of Biani as more of like an all ages book. But it is very much rooted in fairy tales and that kind of storytelling tradition. And, you know, of course, obviously I tried to be really, really true to all of the Filipino aspects to it and kind of keep the details and fill it up with Easter eggs so that too, because I liked the story so much. I really, really, really didn't want to be seen as being like, I'm appropriating this or I'm being disrespectful to these kids. So actually, there's quite a few comic artists that live in the Philippines, and I remember sending several of them pages to like, hey, let me know what you think about this just to make sure, like, am I getting this right? Like, does this feel like maybe even if it doesn't feel authentic, does it feel like are you getting the right, you know, vibe from these creatures? Is this on the right highway at least?
Just ask them if you're pulling a Disney. That's all.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of what I wanted to avoid. You know, I didn't want it to feel insincere. You know, and that's sort of why I, you know, there's scary parts, you know, to the books. And I wanted them to be like funny and have like, you know, soft edges, but at the same time, a lot of the fairy tales are European fairy tales are, you know, bloody and mm-hmm. gross and horrifying. And I found having a 3-year-old that kids are horrifying. They are horrifying little monsters. My 3-year-old has this thing that it's like this whole house that it exists only in his imagination. And it's called the Red House. And he'll tell you, you'll be like, well, you can't have any more applesauce. And he'll be like, at the Red House, I can have all the applesauce I want. Mm. And he's like, man, that is so weird. That's so weird that you have this like mind palace that you like. I feel like it's just like full of trap, like the Chicago murder castle or something is happening. But I guess on the bright side, saved me from having to pay for college. So try not to worry about it too much.
Well, you tell them.
It's all very little. Have like the creepy aspects of Because, you know, when I was reading about this stuff and going to these different websites and reading about it, I'm like, God, these are creepy, weird monsters. And I still want them to come across that way.
Right, right. And of course, you just tell them that in the purple house, there's no more applesauce. So the purple house is in your head. So.
You know what about the purple house? There's not even apples there. There's no applesauce at all. There's no granola bars, and there's no marshmallows. Kids eat what they're told and nothing else.
No marshmallows. I don't want to go to the purple house.
No one does. It's terrible.
Exactly.
That's where Dad lives.
So going back a little bit to, you know, when you were a kid, who were some of your favorite characters that you read?
My characters as a kid, and pretty much my favorite characters now as an adult, are the Marvel space science fiction characters. Silver Surfer, Galactus is my all-time favorite villain. Nova, Adam Warlock. I loved the Guardians of the Galaxy movie. I thought that movie was fantastic. I love Ronan the Accuser. That was always my favorite stuff. I'm not sure why exactly that stuff ended up appealing. I think, honestly, if I had to nail it down as to why that stuff was kind of my favorite, is... are you familiar with the Infinity Gauntlet crossover?
Yep.
From 91-92? Mm-hmm. So the Infinity Gauntlet crossover is happening, and you know, I'm 12 or 13 at the time, and so I go... You know, I go to the grocery store with my mom once a week, and I can get one comic. But she doesn't really care so much about the cover price. If I remember correctly, at the time, the cover price on most comics was like $1.25. But those Infinity Gauntlet ones were like $1.99, but they were twice as big.
Right.
And another thing with my kid brain that really, really appealed to me was there was a shitload of characters on the covers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like for some reason... If you go back and look at, like, my kid comic book collection, there's a lot of covers, lots of characters. Because I guess, like, for me, I was like, well, if there's a bunch of characters on the cover, then I'm going to get a lot more bang for my buck. So I loved that Infinity Gauntlet as a preteen. And that is a lot of, like, the space guys and kind of the pantheon of the Marvel Universe and all that. I mean, I think that my tastes as an adult, you know, veered a little bit more towards... you know, maybe some artsy fartsy stuff. I love Sandman, Neil Gaiman's Sandman. I love Hellboy. You know, that stuff is probably, Preacher. I love Preacher. But, as a kid, definitely the Marvel sci-fi stuff. And, as an adult, I still go back to that stuff from time to time and read it and enjoy it.
Do you think that has any, influence on why you became a research scientist?
Ooh, I never really thought about it, but perhaps. I think it makes sense because I remember when I went to school, I got, you know, I went basically for physics and creative writing, and people would always be like, that's very, like, I want to be a science fiction writer. You know, I want to be Isaac Asimov. and then as it turned out, it was just like, there's so much more money in doing actual research than there is in writing science fiction. You know, so that's just sort of how it worked out. It was one of these weird things where you're in an industry for 10 years just because you're like, I'm incredibly lucky, because so many people's like, they, you know, they hate their job or whatever. I've almost never have had to have that happen. It's almost always been like, hey, I don't mind. This is pretty cool. I don't mind this a bit. But, you know, at one point you're like, I have a career. Oh, how did this happen?
Yeah.
That's weird. You know, there's one thing sort of inexorably led to another, and here I am. But there are worse things. There are worse things. It's allowed me to do a ton of awesome things, like run a comic book publisher and write comics and go to conventions and, you know, and then still have, you know, a pretty fun and satisfying and intellectually challenging day job.
Cool. I don't think a lot of people can say that. So, yeah, I definitely agree. That sounds like fun. You know, so, along those lines of the Infinity Gauntlet, are you looking forward to the movie?
I am. I'm, I really enjoy the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think they've done a really fun, good job with almost all of them. And I do, a lot of people I know, a lot of my friends, they kind of poo-poo them a little bit for all of the comic book super nerd reasons that you could imagine. and if you could kind of make an argument that maybe they're getting a little bloated at this point, but I really enjoy them still, and I'm really looking forward to the movie.
Cool.
Pretty much all the movies. I'm looking forward to Civil War, and I wasn't too excited about Suicide Squad, but I'll probably see that too.
Yeah,
though, to be honest,
not so sure about that one.
it's really, really difficult. Well, the problem is that I wasn't ever a fan of Suicide Squad, right? So it doesn't really have this hold on me, I guess. Where there's like Ronan the Accused, guy for Guardians of the Galaxy, I was like, holy shit.
No, and I don't ever think there was a huge appeal to Suicide Squad. Like, I never thought it had a huge audience. So why they're making that one of the first
That's
movies?
That's awesome. It's because they could shoehorn Harley Quinn into it. That is pretty much literally the reason why.
Yeah.
Because DC was like, we have to do something about this damn Deadpool nonsense. And then someone was like, well, our Deadpool is Harley Quinn. Let's put her into a movie. That's how that came out. I think doesn't look terribly awful. I kind of don't know very much about those characters.
Yeah, that's true.
Not a lot of people do. I mean, it's kind of weird because, okay, Batman movie, great. Everybody knows Batman. Superman movie, yes. We're going to throw Wonder Woman in. Okay, so you go and you see Wonder Woman, great. Even if they did Aquaman, does everybody know who Aquaman is? Yeah, he's the poor guy in the back who likes to talk to his fish. But, you know, the Suicide Squad, it's like, who the hell are they? And DC may be thinking, oh yeah, we're going to pull Guardians of the Galaxy, while at the same time they're writing the memos that say, you know, there will be no humor. This is all dark. We are very dark. So I don't think it's going to... This is coming from the DC guy.
I really feel like... Are you a DC guy?
Yeah, I'm a DC guy.
Do you watch Flash and all that?
Oh, yes. I watch Flash, I'm happy. I watch Arrow, I'm pretty happy. I watch Supergirl, I weep into my tea. And I've stopped doing Gotham because it's just... I'm not into self-flagellation. It's just...
I am with you. I could not agree with you more. It would literally be impossible for me to agree with you more about everything you just said. I really enjoy Flash. Even though Flash really lacks some internal consistency from time to time, yes. I feel like that's unavoidable if you want to screw around with alternate realities and time travel. But it's such an entertaining show, and it has a sense of humor, and there's some lightness to it. Arrow, I think, was really awesome for two seasons, and the third season really started to drag ass a little bit. I still enjoy it. Supergirl, honestly, I haven't even watched one episode. And then I have not seen a single episode of the second season of Gotham. After I felt like I was forcing myself to finish the first season. Just because I was like, you're a comic book guy, you should watch this. But I feel like they did everything wrong. I feel like they did every single thing with Gotham they did wrong. And I hate to say that because, you know, these guys who put it together are talented people, you know, but there's just always so many things you don't know about and do this and make this work. And but I feel like at some point someone was like, we want to make a Gotham and we want to make it be about, you know, Commissioner Gordon and how he becomes the commissioner. And that show should have been about a guy losing, right? Because Commissioner Gordon loses. That's why there has to be a Batman. Like, it's about a guy losing. It's about a city dissolving. And instead, it's about, hey, you like Catwoman? Here she is as a kid. Hey, yeah. You like Poison Ivy? Here she is as a kid.
Yes, they were all there. You know, there. Oh, look, here's Enigma. Here's Cobblepot. I mean, everybody's. It's like they were all there in the beginning, but you know,
too much for me. It was too much. Like I was really interested in the idea of making a show about the city and how it's falling apart, and then bring Batman in like season 3 or something. as you're about to wrap it up.
I think, I honestly feel like the original pitch was, we'll take, Jim Gordon and Cobblepot, and we'll have them both go on their journey. One becomes the hero, the other becomes the villain, you know, and you watch both of them rise to power. And that would have been an interesting show. But then I think someone got cold feet, someone got scared and said, oh, no one's going to watch this. Let's throw in Catwoman. Let's throw in young Bruce Wayne, you know, and, you know, I think if they had stuck to their guns, it would have been a good show, but.
Well, it's the difference between. It's the difference between, on the Marvel side, the fans are in control, less so now than originally, but still, you know, have a lot of control. And, you know, on the DC side, they're going for the four quadrants and they, you know, well, let's add more people that everybody knows in order to, you know, get more of an audience. And they're just, the executives are in charge.
I feel like that's very, very accurate. I feel like it's very accurate. And yeah. The reason I asked you about it to begin with is, don't you wish that the DC movies would feel a little bit more like the Flash TV show?
Yeah.
That's kind of how I feel. I feel like they should try to make it feel more like the TV show. Like, because there's something inherently silly about the whole idea, and you should embrace it so that people can get past it and engage in the drama that you're trying to tell them. You know, and I feel like the TV show Flash hits that balance really, really well. And I haven't seen a DC movie that does it very well.
Right. And that's something that I love Flash, and I've been watching every episode since the beginning. In fact, you know, I try to make sure I watch it live every Tuesday at 8 o'clock so that I don't accidentally see any spoilers online or anything. They got that show so right. Like, everyone has said this, that loves the show. They took a comic book and brought it to life. And no other show feels that way, really. No movie, the movies feel like that to some extent, but they got it so right in the show. So why can't they, you know, repeat this over and over again, you know?
Yeah, I wish that they, I think Marvel movies do it a lot better than the DC ones do. But then again, I often find myself in the minority, but I was not really a big fan of the Christopher Nolan Batmans. I thought they were, I don't know, maybe like too dark, maybe. Though, really? You know, obviously, yeah, for instance, the Dark Knight, right? To me, the Dark Knight is like a really, truly great performance by Heath Ledger, surrounded by kind of a lame movie. Because I felt like every time, like when I was watching it, I feel like I'm just waiting for the next time the Joker comes on, and all the rest of it's just filler. But the biggest sin, I think, with the whole Christopher Nolan verse is that Batman is, at his heart, he's not a guy who runs around and beats people up. He's a detective, and he's the greatest detective in the world. And the Christopher Nolan Batman is a moron who cannot figure out anything at all on his own. He does no detecting at all, ever.
Right. He just taps into everybody's cell phones and listens into that.
Well, and that's kind of really Lucius Fox who does that. I don't know.
Just... he did nothing.
No, it's so funny. You're the first person has said that, and now that I'm thinking about it, it's like, oh my god, that's so true. Because even you go back to the 89 Batman, they made a point of, like, Batman's the one who figures out that the Joker...
He's doing chemistry, like, in his lab, you know?
Right, right. He figures out that, oh, the Smilex has been broken out into all these different... So, like, deodorant plus hairspray is what's going to kill you, not just hairspray, and... And that's a detective, yeah. And they made a point of doing that in the movie, but poor Bale, he just goes around beating people up.
Yeah, he just beats people up, but it's like action movie sequence, a bunch of them glued together. I don't know. They really didn't appeal to me at all. I don't know. I'm kind of looking forward to the Batman versus Superman movie that's supposed to be coming out here relatively soon. Right. I don't know how excited I am. The previews certainly make it look cool.
Well, I think if they do this one thing in the movie, I have said this before. If they have Bruce Wayne figure out Clark Kent is Superman, and I understand he's just wearing glasses, but given the history of the DC universe, and we know we're not supposed to be able to figure it out, but if Batman figures it out on his own, which he has done in the comics and in the movies, I mean, and in the cartoons, and because of his, you know, detective abilities, and then, okay, I'll be okay with Batfleck.
The Batfleck part, that doesn't really even bother me a bit. It's really more about Batman's just, he should be a detective to me.
Right.
You know, that's kind of his shtick. Like, if you've ever read Identity Crisis by, what's his name? It's a really famous novelist.
Yeah.
Ed Meltzer wrote it. So in that, the whole kind of premise of the thing is half of the Justice League sort of covers up a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And Zatanna changes Batman's memories, and they're all like, we have got to make sure he never finds out that this happens, or we are all dead. And right? The entire sort of premise, and of course he figures it out. He figures out that his own brain has been tampered with, you know, and this memory erase, and it all goes back to, like, Dr. Light raping Sue Dibney, I think. It's been a long time since I read that. But I realize I sound like a huge dork right now.
No.
What podcast you're on, right? It's
yeah. So, but the whole kind of, like, the mystique of Batman is that these guys who have, like, supernatural powers,
right,
are a little bit afraid of him all the time because he has a plan. He's the only hero that has a plan to take down every other hero,
including himself.
Yeah, he has a doomsday plans. Like, Superman goes nuts, this is how we take him out. You know?
No, definitely, yeah. And that's always been shown in the comics. Again, yeah, Identity Crisis is a great story that shows that, where, like, we need to make sure he'll never figure this out, and yet he does figure it out. So, yes, no, definitely. Well, we'll see. We got, at this point when we're recording this, a week and a half to the movie, so keeping my fingers crossed.
Oh, yeah. That's soon, because I've got C2E2. I leave tomorrow for C2E2.
Oh, wow.
And then, so that'll be through, and then, like, Monday I'll recover, and then, yeah, I probably won't even be able to see it, at least for several weeks.
Okay.
So,
we won't ruin it for you.
I don't think it's one of those things that couldn't be ruined. I think it would only be a matter of, like, it's like if someone was like, well, it's sort of like this storyline mixed with this storyline, then I'd be like, ah, got it.
So, okay, so since you are more of a Marvel fan, I'm going to ask you this question too. We were just postulating on the episode that went up this week about Civil War, and given how there's been a lot of rumors about somebody's going to die in this movie, do you think Marvel will have one of its heroes kill one of its other heroes? Or do you think that idea is just too far-fetched, or won't work in the movie?
Book, which I think Civil War, is the greatest of all of Marvel's crossovers, and I think that you could make a very strong argument that Marvel especially has jumped the shark on crossovers now because their business model is just, like, release enough books to get to the next giant crossover and then cancel all that out to release a bunch more books to get to the next one. But in the era of Civil War, which I want to say was 2005 or 2006, I think they were really doing it right, and I really like Civil War. So in Civil War, what happens? One of the great things about Civil War, I'm going to preface this a little bit, is that Mark Millar, who I'm not a fan of everything he's done, but he's done enough that I would say that I'm a fan of his work. Mm. I think he did a really good job making both sides seem good and both sides seem bad. Mm-hmm. Like, it was difficult to be like, I'm 100% behind Cap, or I'm 100% behind Tony.
Right.
Right. I think, so you have, what is it? It's Tony and Mr. Fantastic, I think, do some mad science and Thor, and then Thor offs Goliath in the books, right?
Right. Well, it actually turns out not to be Thor, but a replicant of Thor, or a robot.
Like a clone. And then Thor actually shows up after, and he's super pissed.
Right.
And then he gives one of the best lines ever in the Thor miniseries that I think Straczynski wrote when it came back, when he's like, you need to go home, Tony, before you learn the difference between a god of thunder and a man in a metal suit. Which is, that's a gangster line.
That's Michael Straczynski, right?
Yes.
I think that was, J. Michael Straczynski. Yeah, I think he's the one who did that Thor miniseries that was like just after Civil War happened.
He's a really good writer.
Oh, yeah, he's. If you ever watched Babylon 5, that was
his. I've been following him before that. I remember Captain Power and the Soldiers of the Future, but go ahead.
Oh, holy crap. That's way back when the, like, into the deep 80s. That's almost before my time watching. Wow.
Welcome to my world.
Was that the show where you could buy like a laser gun and shoot back at the TV?
Yes.
Oh man, I have some very sketchy memories about that. But I do
remember. Yeah, well, it was supposed to be just to sell toys, and then Straczynski started writing episodes and it turned into this epic thing that ended because they didn't want it to be anything more than a vehicle for toys. But he ended it in a way that made you want to see a second season.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I remember nothing about it, but I'm a fan of J. Michael Straczynski, so maybe I can probably find these on YouTube or something, and I will give them a look.
You would have liked it. It got really dark.
I promise you I've watched worse things. So. anyway, so they kill Goliath, right?
Right.
And then, I think that they will kill somebody, so you gotta think in terms of business, right? So they've created a bunch of stars with these movies, right? Yeah. Like Chris Evans is a huge star now. Robert Downey Jr. is as big of a star as you can be now, thanks to Iron Man. Hemsworth is a huge star. Chris Pratt is a huge star. A lot of these guys are big, big stars. And eventually, I think you start running into the thing of like, well, we can't pay everyone $50 million.
Right.
So how do you get the most emotional punch and the biggest, like, oh my God, without losing the ability to tell the story you want to tell and eliminate a guy who's too expensive?
CGI.
True. I honestly feel like they kind of are teasing you to make you think that it's going to be Don Cheadle, the War Machine.
Yeah, yeah.
Guys, but I do not think that's going to be the case. I think that it's going to be Iron Man. I think it's going to be RDJ.
You sure it's not going to be a Black Widow, seeing as how you can't find any of her toys?
The sarcastic joke aside,
I hope not. That would...
We still want to see her in the cat suit, John, so shh.
Yeah. No, seriously, I think it's going to be Downey Jr. I think they're going to they get rid of him, then they don't have to pay him the big money. They can put just about anybody to be the new Iron Man in a suit and still have all the fun stuff. And he's already gone through three movies. I don't see an Iron Man 4, 5, and 6.
No, and I think I do think there is talk that his contract is over at the end of this movie. This was his last contracted movie to do. So that is possible.
Really? See, I didn't know that. That really makes me think. I mean, and plus, that would be the one thing where people would be like, wow, I can't believe you killed Iron Man off. But then again, you have to remember, this is comics, so...
Right. That is
so he gets resurrected for the Infinity Gauntlet, right?
I tell you what, dude, I would not be surprised if in 10 years from now, if we're not having a conversation about, like, so you guys remember when Walking Dead finally went off the air, and then we went 8 years with no zombies, and now they're making a Marvel Zombies movie. I honestly would not be surprised.
No, I do think that's in the ethos somewhere. But the thing with Civil War, which is interesting, two things. The one rumor is they actually filmed three death scenes. And they're not saying they're using any. They're not saying which one they're using, but it's, the idea was they did that to throw everyone off. Like, they don't know who's, even the actors don't know, you know, who it is that dies in the movie. But the other thing is that I actually met Mark Miller, I want to say 2 years after Civil War came out,
And that was the question, you know, usually when you meet somebody you like and they're signing something for you, you get to ask one or two questions. And my question was, I read this book, I love it, but I kind of feel the ending's a little, you know, was a little soft, because they just kind of look at the damage they're doing, they say, oh, we give up, and they stop fighting. I said, is this originally how you planned it to end? And he's like, no, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. My original ending was Captain America dies, and that's what makes everyone stop, because they're like, oh my God, we've killed Captain America, we need to stop, this is crazy. But Marvel had already been planning to kill Steve Rogers in another book, you know, and so they said, no, you can't kill him, so he had to change his ending. So,
so somebody would think that would have been a more powerful ending.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
So, I mean, the thing is, it's like, yes, that would be interesting, but I don't think they're going to kill Captain America in his own movie, but, you know, we'll see.
No, I would have a really hard time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can see it really making sense plot wise. I can see it really making sense. And then they try to make, you know, Bucky becomes, and plus there's precedent in the comics.
Right.
Like the hardcore fans would probably love it, because they'd be like, it's just like the comics.
Right. And then after Bucky, you can have, that Falcon takeover, like it was for a little while.
Oh, wait.
So.
Yep.
Nice. Yeah, but we'll see. I think RDJ makes the most sense. I think his contract's up. I think, you know, he's making the most of anyone right now.
So I probably by a relatively huge margin, I would imagine.
Right. Well, he kicked the whole thing off, you know? So now it's an accounting decision.
He's an awesome Iron Man. He's an Tony Stark. He basically is Tony Stark.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and
yeah, it's perfect. It's perfect casting, like they did with Chris Pratt. I mean, you know, and
exactly, yeah. Chris Pratt is Peter Quill. It's definitely
right. That's why we need John O'Grady to play Squirrel Girl.
No, no, nay. You leave my waifu alone, okay?
Oh my God.
Cool. So, wow, we've actually been, you know, we've been at this for about an hour now. So, you know, we're getting near the end here. So one question I always like to ask, our guests is, how do you measure success?
Kind of two different ways. So for the publisher, I do panels at cons and ask this sort of thing a lot. And the answer is, yes, I publish stuff because I want to see it made, because I personally like it and I think that it should be made, even if I suspect that it is unlikely to sell very well and that we are unlikely to make money from it. But the reality is that I cannot do that, very often, or I won't be able to do it at all. So as a publisher, I feel like I'm a little bit more mercenary, in terms of trying to, because I want to keep the company alive so that we can continue to make cool stuff. So, you know, I do try to look at when people send me pitches, you know, you have to bring a lot to the table these days. And one of the things we ask for is, you know, how do you see this marketing? You know, how would you market this book? Who do you market it to? Who's your audience? How do you break into it? How does your pitch work? You know, how does your pitch work at a store? You know, we ask creators to think about all those types of things.
Right.
You know, for the publisher, it's a lot of those. As a writer, I got a, last week, I got some fan mail in the mail to my house. And it was probably like, and it's the first time I've ever gotten any actual physical mail, you know, not like a message on a Facebook page or something. They're like, hey, I read your thing. It's really cool. I got a letter in the mail from an 8-year-old girl whose dad had bought the first 3 issues of Biani from me at a show a few weeks before.
This is on your Twitter feed, isn't it?
I did. I posted it on my Twitter feed. And it was the most, like, heartwarming and validating thing. There isn't anything in my career of writing and having things published and doing conventions that is even like close to this. And being like, wow, that is so awesome that this 8-year-old girl thought enough of this thing to be like, I want to write him a letter. And it's so great. In the letter, she says things like, this book is very colorful. It has colors like, and then she lists off like 15 colors that were in the book, which I think is the most charming thing ever. I want to put that on the back of the Volume 2 trade, you know? Like, this book is very colorful. Yeah, these are the colors.
That would be perfect.
It is so awesome and so, like, incredibly sincere. Oh, it was really, really touching. And I found it to be incredibly validating because essentially, like, the heart of your target audience, right? Like, your meat and potatoes for this book, like, thought enough of it to sit down and write on a piece of paper with a pencil, and she, like, colored parts of it and then put it in there and then ask her dad for a stamp and to put it in the mail for her was, I'm almost getting a little choked up, actually. It's like, you know, because I think about it from, like, if I were a dad and one of my kids was like, I want to send this mail to this guy, I, as a dad, would be like, we're going to buy every single thing that this person does.
Right, exactly.
I shouldn't say I don't care, but that was far more validating to me than a royalty check.
Cool.
That felt incredibly good.
No, I mean, I definitely agree. I think that's a wonderful story. And, you know, I mean, you know, if you're anyone who's getting into a pursuit like that, you know, you definitely don't go into it for the money, you know, especially comics. You don't go into it for the money, people.
Don't go into it for the money. Now, you can make a little bit of it if you're really careful and you try really, really hard. But for the most part, you should really dig it. Because
right, you do it for the love, and then if you can get the love back from your audience, you know you're doing a good job.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
And it was fine, and you know, made me feel like $1 million.
Cool. So, as we're wrapping it up here, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at tmcintyre1. You can also follow SourcePoint Press at SourcePTPress and on Facebook, SourcePoint Press, and our website, SourcePointPress.com. You can go to CaliberComics.com or CaliberEntertainment.com, or I think Caliber.com, I think, is them too. Or maybe it's an ammunition website. I'm not. but most of the Caliber Comics or Caliber Entertainment all goes to the same place. You can go there. Biani is... I think the single issues are getting harder to get, but the trade, the Volume 1 trade, is available. So if anybody's interested in it, you can pick it up from the Caliber website or order it from your from your local store. Or if and this is probably extremely unlikely, but maybe there is one on the shelf. I don't know. Probably not, would be my guess. But because mostly people have to order it for a store to actually get it in. But that's there. And you know, SourcePoint has a web store. I also do around 30 conventions or so a year. So like this month I'm in C2E2 this next weekend, and then I think Indiana, and then Los Angeles, and then I'm all over the country. Orlando, Boston, Baltimore, Philadelphia in a month or two. So yeah, I'm relatively easy to find. We're all over the place. We've got C2E2. We have a whole bunch of new stuff coming out.
Cool. So Philadelphia first weekend in June, right?
Is that one in Philadelphia Comic Con?
It's
we're there for that.
Right, Wizard World Philly.
No.
Philadelphia Comic Con.
It's the other one.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Or is it the Great Philadelphia Comic Con?
Yeah, the Great Philadelphia.
Okay, Comic-Con. Okay,
that's the one I'll be in.
That's next month. That's in April.
Yep.
Okay.
I knew it was coming up. I knew it was coming up soon.
All right. Cool.
But yeah, new. We're all over the place. So yeah, come see us. Come see what we've got going on new. When does this show actually post?
On Wednesdays. So yeah.
So next one.
Yes.
Okay. Cool.
For those people listening, it's this Wednesday, today.
Right. It is today. Sorry. but because this it will be Wednesday when people actually hear this, but probably the biggest thing was Sourcepoint, and I think, I mean, we have Nora by Casey Pierce, Sean Seal comes out, The Rot by David Hayes comes out, Gary Reed and Seth DeMoose, who's done a bunch of awesome stuff, with Image, comes out this weekend, and, Dead Duck and Zombie Chick, by Jay Fosgate, who's the current artist on, Rocket and Groot. That's his creator-owned book, about a dead duck and his sidekick, and it's extremely funny. Those all come out this weekend, but we also just wrapped up a licensing agreement with Arescope Pictures and filmmaker Adam Green, who made all the Hatchet movies and Digging Up the Marrow. So we're doing the comic book adaptation of his TV show, Holliston.
Okay,
and cool. The announcement for that happens at C2E2, which will be 3 days.
Yes,
of you listening,
that'll be in the past. Cool,
but still. So this will be like the first podcast that it gets mentioned on.
That's going to be coming out.
And for us, you know, as a horror publisher, to get like, you know, he's kind of like the Kevin Smith of horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a massive. A pleasure and an extremely difficult thing to not talk about over the last 3 months.
Oh, okay. Cool. Of course, Kevin Smith is starting to become the Kevin Smith of horror movies. With Tusk.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Tusk. I don't know if you guys have seen it.
I haven't seen it.
I did really enjoy it.
I haven't seen it, but I'm actually really interested in seeing Yoga Hosers, so.
I'm kind of a fan of Kevin Smith, I think that if you're a podcaster, I think that you, people jet down with Kevin Smith,
right?
Because he's sort of like the patron saint of nerdy podcasters.
Yes, he is. All hail Kevin Smith. Oh,
yeah, and he does a ton of shows that I really like. I don't know about you guys, but Edumacation is probably my favorite of all his shows. That's probably the one that I listen to weekly, or as often as it's on. I'm a fan of almost all of his movies. I guess he is sort of becoming the Kevin Smith of horror in a way. But I don't know if it really counts because he didn't like come up through the indie ranks. He's kind of to the point where he's like, well, if it's cheap enough, he can make whatever he wants, you know?
Right. Well, that's true.
That's how you get to make Moose Jaws.
Yes, it's Jaws, but with a moose.
Right. Which is an awesome, that's a great log line. I don't know how they didn't get even more money for that. Like, it's Jaws, but it's a moose. What? That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Here's $10 million.
There you go. Cool. All right. I think that's a good place to put a pin in for this week. And as always, ladies and gentlemen, all the links to find Travis and his books are be in the description. If you're an 8-year-old girl, please get your parents' permission before you buy one of his books. And as always, well, I don't want to get anyone in trouble. And as always, don't let your cape get caught in the door. Have a good week.
Thank you for listening to the latest Superhero Speak. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or anywhere podcasts are available. And also, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Superhero Speak or on Facebook, facebook.com/SuperheroSpeak. Join the conversation.